pastor's heart, and we have it wrong on secularism. Or that's what Rory Shiner says. We have accepted hook, line and sinker, a narrative that just isn't true. And as a result, we're making pastoral and missional mistakes. Rory Shiner is the senior pastor of Providence Church in Perth in Western Australia. Rory, if we could start with your pastor's heart, and if we do believe the lie on this, it's going to fill us with despair, isn't it? But you're saying there's actually some hope.
Yeah, I do think there's some real hope. I think the as we're going to talk about in this time, I think the secularism is a big beast, and it looks sort of overwhelming and kind of monolithic. But I think its explanatory power is weak, and I am hopeful for the future that the light of Jesus will shine more clearly against this background.
So tell us the lie that we've come to believe and how we've come to believe it.
Well, this is the thing. So I was doing some research a few years ago, and I was, it was in kind of 20th century history, and I noticed that I myself had had an understanding of secularism that I think is the default understanding that the average person you sit next to on the bus or at work has. And it goes something like this, that Christianity, say 500 years ago, just had cornered the explanatory power. That's how we understood everything. And then one by one, round after round, basically science beat Christianity. That you had the scientific revolution, 1600s, you had the Enlightenment in the 1700s, Darwin's Origin of Species in the 1859. And I think the picture people have is just that round after round, Christianity had to recede and recede and recede, and science just had explanatory power that Christianity couldn't keep up with. And so Christianity's had this kind of long, slow 500-year death, and now we're at this moment where it's just on its last legs and it's staggering around like a once great kind of prize fighter, but we all secretly know it's about to keel over and either, you know, disappear altogether or at least become very marginal. So Damien Thompson from The Spectator in the UK has calculated that the last Christian in Britain will die in 2067 on a linear projection from the way Christianity is going there at the moment. So that's the kind of, that's the story I think we have, that and that story is long, slow, linear decline from about 500 years ago. The culprit is science, and science just keeps winning, and Christianity just keeps getting pushed further and further to the margins, and it's on its way out. I think that's the story that I think I had somewhere in my head, and I think most of us carry, maybe not with that level of articulation, but that most of us carry around with us.
And there are all sorts of contributing factors to that. You cited somewhere the example of no religion anymore in the census.
Yeah, this is exactly. So I think we, as humans, we tend to think not in terms of, you know, bullet points or propositions. We tend to think in stories. And I noticed that at the census a few years ago, the Australian Atheist Foundation put out a campaign. I think it was an in good faith campaign, so I'm not being critical of it. And they were saying their cause was to say, listen, if you're not Christian, don't put down Christian. If you're not religious, don't put down religious. And they were shadowboxing with what they perceive, and maybe fairly, as a problem in the census data, that people are ticking Christian, even though Christian has no impact on their life or policy choices or whatever. So that was the cause. But the campaign had this sign, like a billboard, and it the sentence was, not religious anymore, ? And what you notice in that is that if you just said not religious ? Then it's a simple proposition. Are you religious? Yes or no. But when you say not religious anymore, you're actually involving people in a story. And the story is a story that goes, once upon a time, we were all very religious. But then along came, let's say, science, and science started to explain things better than Christianity could. And now lots of people aren't religious. And what about you? Are you still religious, or are you not religious anymore? It's got a similar kind of rhetorical impact to the Make America Great Again campaign. You know, if that sign just said, if the hat just said Make America Great, that's kind of boring. But if you say Make America Great Again, then you've got a story. There's a there was a point where America was great, and that greatness has gone missing, and maybe we could make it great again. And I think that idea of not religious anymore captures for me the narrative that so many people in our culture carry in our head, that we all used to be religious, we were right into it, and now most of us aren't, and it's on its way out.
As you say that, you said you kind of stumbled upon this in your PhD research. Take us to that PhD moment for you.
Yeah, so I was doing some research on an Australian Christian leader called Donald Robinson. We've talked about him before on the show. And I was working chronologically. He was born in 1947. And so I had to do a bit of reading around, you know, what life was like in that. Born in 1922. Went to university in England in 1947. So born in the 20s. So you had to read up on what was life like in the 20s and the 30s, 40s, 50s. 60s and so on. And I bought to that bit of research, that question. I thought, I bet you Australia was very religious in the 20s and it would have been a bit less religious in the 30s and 40s and so on. And that turned out not to be the case. In actual fact, the 1920s and 30s in Australia, Christianity was very weak. It was a really rough time for the churches and poor church attendance and so on, back then. Whereas from 1945 to 1963, Australia lived through its greatest ever revival of church attendance. So people after 1945 started going to church again. When Billy Graham came in 1959, Billy Graham did an extraordinary thing, but what he did came after 15 or more years of really solid growth in the Christian churches. And so I remember looking at that and thinking, wait a minute, that doesn't fit with my story. Because if my story's right, then Christianity's just on this long, slow decline. So what's Australia doing, you know, not being very
bucking
engaged?
Bucking that trend, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And it turns out to be a trend that's not just in Australia. And so in all sorts of ways, the data, I mean, another example is in the if the science beat Christianity story is true, Charles Darwin puts out Origin of Species in 1859, and so you would think, well, if that story checks out, this is where Christianity receives a fatal blow. But actually, Christianity goes gangbusters all across the second half of the 19th century. That's when that's peak evangelicalism in many ways in the UK. That's when the great missionary movements are being sent out and so on. And so you start to think the data isn't behaving according to the hypothesis.
And so what's your new hypothesis?
Well, so it turns out that I don't have any new hypotheses at all. It turns out I was just ignorant of what everyone else outside the inside the field knew. So, I just thought secularization, caused largely by science, was the taken for granted thing. But it turns out it's a very kind of complicated field. And there's a whole bunch of people, probably a majority, I would say, of sociologists who would say that in a really real way, secularization is a myth. Linda Woolhead is a sociologist, and she says that to say that the West has become less religious, measured by church attendance, it's like saying that the West is less into communications because of the decline of telegraph poles. We're measuring some of the wrong things. Some of the other problems with the thesis are that in the medieval era, we think of that as like wall-to-wall religious. Actually, church attendance was pretty thin. A lot of the priests didn't know Latin. They just mumbled in, there are councils that tell people in medieval Europe to start going to church once a year to take the mass and so on. So we have a bit of a myth about how religious the ancient or the kind of medieval world was, and we're comparing often the 20th century against the 19th century, which was a freakishly successful time for evangelical Christianity. I think the more persuasive alternative to what happened in our culture and what's happened to the place of Christianity and secularisation. I do think there's such a thing as secularisation, but I think that what's caused it is not science, but a whole set of conditions of belief of which science is a part but not the whole. It also includes technology, birth rates, patterns of economics and so on that have all kind of conspired to push Christian life and religious life more generally, not off the picture altogether, but into the margins of culture. The way Charles Taylor, the philosopher, describes it is he says, we've been put, modern people, especially after the 1960s, we've been put into a thing that he calls the imminent frame, which is a big, you know, $10 word. But all he's saying is that the transcendent questions of God, ultimate truth, judgment, beauty, and so on, have been framed out of our lives. And so you and I get on the bus and go into town and do our things, and we can go shopping, we can pick up the kids from school, the kids can have an education, we can go play soccer. All these things can happen with no reference to any religious or transcendent ideas. So like a picture frame, questions of God have been framed out of our culture, which is different from saying they've been defeated. I don't think our culture has mounted the case against the existence of God or the truth of Christian claims. It's just said, hey guys, let's not bother about that here. Let's do education without God, and let's do sport without God, and let's do all these things. Let's frame those questions out and get on with life without him. That's the situation we're in, and we all live in that frame. And that frame has, I think, profound implications for the way we think about God and the Christian faith.
I mean, what's the difference in terms of how we approach it missionally if it's been a defeat versus it's we're just not talking about it?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges for us in mission is that because that framing has been so successful, we've been, as a culture, we've really worked out how to do most things without reference for God. And it creates the optical illusion that God is not relevant to most things. But of course, he's relevant to all things. It's just that we've managed to frame him out. I think in terms of mission and in terms of church planting and discipleship, I think the big change that we do have to reckon with, especially in Australia, but this is true elsewhere, is that we have moved from becoming a society that, as Les Murray, the poet, used to put it, was roughly Christian. We came out of a culture in Australia where in 1901, 95% of our population said they were Christian. And that has declined, the amount of people who say they're Christian. That's dropped off significantly since the 1960s and precipitously since the 2000s. So according to McCrindle, the drop of people who said, I am Christian, dropped, and it was the biggest drop of anything ever recorded in the census. From 2011 to 2016, something like 950,000 people said, oh, we're not Christian anymore. But here's the thing that's significant for mission. Those people, those 950,000 people who said they were Christian in 2011 and said they weren't in 2016, they weren't in church. They weren't, you know, at our churches and suddenly thought, oh, I don't think God's real. What happened is our culture became a culture where a lot of people who instinctively said, oh, what religion are we again, honey? I think we're Church of England. So I guess that's Christian, is it? And they would tick the box. They now feel comfortable to say, oh, I'm nothing. And so we're in a situation where we've had to move from being, Christians used to be the intensive form of the culture. So when Billy Graham comes in 1959 and he's on mission here, he's preaching at the MCG and he mainly talks about being born again. And you think, oh, the Bible only talks about being born again two or three times really, but he talks about it all the time. Why? Because more than 70% of the people he's talking to already think they're Christian. And so he has to say, yeah, I know you're Presbyterian or you're Catholic or you're Anglican or something, but do you have a personal relationship with Jesus? Whereas if you gathered together, you know, that many people in the MCG again, at this moment in our history, fewer than 50% would even claim they're Christian. And so we now have to think of ourselves not as a intensive form of the culture, but as an alternative to the culture, which does shape the way we do mission and the way we do discipleship.
I mean, I have a memory of being in infant school in 1971 and a conversation with, I mean, I was a Roman Catholic at that stage, but a conversation with peers about how outrageous it was these people who talked about being born again thought they were the only Christians. Now, as I think about different evangelistic tracks, Alpha starts with Christianity boring, irrelevant, untrue. And I think the Alpha course was written really to pitch itself at that group, the kind of come and work out what Christianity properly is, do you know? And so pitching to that first group that you were describing it. Whereas I remember when we wrote Introducing God, we're actually, I mean, if you're going to write a course called Introducing God, you're pitching at a group who are happy to call themselves not Christian and not don't have a relationship with God. I wonder if you've thought about that in terms of how this thesis of where people are at would influence your starting point for evangelism.
Yeah, I think that's right, Dominic. I think you noticed that a lot of we made that big shift, I think, in the 80s and 90s to course-based evangelism and often evangelism in homes or around meals. And that was an important shift in response to the evangelistic environment, because unlike Billy Graham in 1959, Billy Graham could rely on the idea that everyone had all this stuff in their heads and he just needed to get it in the right order. And I think Alpha properly and rightly recognises that. But I think you're right that up until the early to mid, let's say 2010 for an arbitrary date. Up till then, one of the things that you could really get some traction on is to say, hey, listen, Christianity, that thing that you think is a bit goofy and annoying and stuff, actually, we can give you the authentic version and it's more interesting than you think. And there you could get great traction from being relevant. So what some of the important work that people did in evangelism in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s in Australia was to not have such a high bar on things like liturgy, making church services more accessible, making evangelism more course-based and home-based and so on, and where you could trade on that idea that, as someone described it in the American situation, which is a bit different from here, but they said their thing was America used to be Christian positive. So if you said you were Christian, you already had an in, because they were like, oh, well, that's probably a good force in our culture, to Christian neutral, and we're just moving into a point where it's Christian negative. In the Christian neutral environment, as long as you were winsome and, you know, you wore tight enough jeans or presented nice enough food and presented Christianity as less boring than people expected, you had a hearing. Whereas we're now into a situation where Christianity is often seen as a kind of even a malevolent force in our culture, and we're trying to commend something to people that they might be hostile to, and that that relevance is not the big problem.
So if you wouldn't start with that boring, irrelevant, untrue, where might you start today?
So I'd be more inclined to say, yeah, boring, irrelevant, untrue, I think is tapping on a question that fewer and fewer people have in their head. I think I would want to start with inviting people into this whole worldview to say, there was a book years ago from the 1970s called The Universe Next Door, which was a Christian book about the way the person next to you thought about their world, the Hindu, the atheist, the Buddhist and so on. And I think we need to invite people into the universe that's next door to them, which is the Christian universe, and commend that to them as a whole worldview. Which I think is exactly where things like Introducing God and other course-based evangelism has moved us to say, Bridge to Life implies so much prior knowledge, whereas I think we're on the right track in thinking that actually this is a long, slow release. It involves relationships. It's around food. And I might have got this from you actually, Dominic, but I'll say it back to you. I think the longer you can have people, the better. If there's any way to keep people going, in a Christian environment. And, you know, if you've got a 4-week course and you can follow that up with a 4-week course on this and that and spin that out, the longer you can have people around food in community with the Christian worldview being like Narnia, like opening up the wardrobe and discovering this whole world. I think that's really the way we need to think about the evangelistic task.
Well, I mean, I certainly believe what you've just said, although I hadn't thought it through from the secular point of view, or the way you were describing it earlier. I just got the idea of my goal in the first date is second date. And so my goal in the second date is third date. My goal in the... And so I don't want to ask them to marry me on the first night. I want them to come back and gradually meet this God that's made such a difference in my life. Yeah. How is this... I mean, it's 2-3 years since you had this penny drop as you were doing your PhD. How's it changed your evangelistic and pastoral practice at church, apart from what we've just been saying?
Yeah, so I think in terms of pastoral practice and discipleship, I think we increasingly think we're preparing our children and the next generation not to fit in, but to learn what it is like to not fit in. I remember Philip Jensen said a few years ago in some context or other that he grew up in, I think, Bondi or in the eastern suburbs where there's a big Jewish population in Sydney. And he said that Gentile kids are raised to fit in and Jewish kids are told, you're different, here's how to be different. And I think as we're no longer the intensive form of the culture but an alternative form to the culture, we increasingly can't subcontract things to... you know, education or the sports club or whatever. We need to be able to form those tight communities. I think we need youth groups where they're not just entertainment or not even just didactic, but they're formative, to use the pretentious language, that they're places where you think, what's the purpose of this youth group? It's to give them a gang of peers that they're together around the scripture, spurring one another on as they live out a minority view on sexual ethics, a minority view on the meaning and purpose of life and so on. I think we need to really work hard in discipleship. But I think actually we're, in many ways, I don't think secularism has outthought us, but it has out-discipled us. I think secularism is actually very weak. Its explanatory power is very limited. It can't really make sense of beauty or agency or morality. It's an intellectually weak and thin worldview, but it's formatively so strong that every film you see and every action you take in the society is forming you to think that that's the way to live. And so our churches need to do what we certainly didn't need to do in the 50s and 60s and even 70s, is to be an alternative kind of formative community. I think with evangelism... I think we need to be excited about just kind of how weird the Christian worldview is. We're no longer just giving people little tidbits and saying, oh, you know about God, Jesus, and the Bible, but you didn't know that Jesus died for your sins. And then, bing, or you have to be born again, bing. We're doing that kind of Narnia wardrobe thing. And I think we need to be enthusiastic about that. Just think, this is fantastic. If people can understand this, not only will they be saved from an eternity without God and under his judgment, which is, you know, that's worth it on itself, but they'll be rescued from this thin, meaningless worldview that's full of anxiety and here's this thing that is better and richer and a deeper account of life. I think all the things that you've said and observed and helped us with of how long you need to work with people, how far back you need to start, and how much those relational situations really matter. And as Sam Chan's taught us, the context really matters, that our culture finds it really hard for philosophical reasons, finds it really hard to talk about God at work or in the public space, and we need to address that. But we have got space around a meal table to talk about values and ultimate concern. So I think those moves are really... crucial for us.
Mm. And I think, just as you were saying, I think there's perhaps an intentional opportunity for us to take, in terms of if we've been framed out of the conversation, to frame the gospel back into the conversation. And so, I mean, as you were speaking, I was just thinking about a conversation. I had a meeting with a real estate agent this morning, and the opening line from her was, "How was your Christmas?" Do you know? And because we hadn't spoken since November, and I was able to talk about our kids' club, do you know, the last couple of days at church. And so it's just putting back God.
Absolutely. I reckon I say to people, he's from worst to best. When someone, you see someone at work on Monday and they say, "What did you do on the weekend?" The worst thing is to say, "I watched the footy." The second best thing is to say, "I watched the footy and went to church." But the best thing to say is, they say, "What did you do on the weekend?" And you say, "Oh, on my weekend at our church, we were looking at the idea of God's creation and what that means for us. It was fascinating." And then you stump it up there, and you've broken through that imminent frame, and you've done something that a lot of people don't have. You've indicated that your beliefs actually have you in a community, and you're in a church where you're not just going through the motions, which is probably what most people think we're doing in church, where you're actually learning things and discovering things and so on. So I think, again, I think this is Sam Chan, but lots of people say this, that you know, you want to mix those communities, break open that thing of your friends being their friends, of going to that third, you know, not just I went to the footy or just that I went to church, but that at our church we explored this or did that or learnt about this mission work that was happening in Bulgaria.
Or even if you don't go for the central thesis of the meeting, but you just say, "Oh, here's a funny joke that happened that I heard at church last night," so that I'm smashing a preconception about what church would be like, even if I'm not arguing for the central thesis of the meeting. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Hey, Rory, thanks very much for talking to us.
Great. Pleasure.
Rory Shine has been my guest. This has been The Pastor's Heart. Rory, of course, the senior minister of Providence Church in Perth in Western Australia. And we will look forward to your company next Tuesday afternoon.
Hey, if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, we would love it if you could hop over to the Apple Podcasts app and give us a rating and review. That helps us in the rankings and lets other people discover The Pastor's Heart. And again, if you are able to help us out by being a financial partner, go to our Patreon link, patreon.com/thepastorsheart.